and welcome to your weekly dose of the latest sustainability fund news, facts and reviews brought to you by the Green Elephant. This week, a number of unexpected climate change stories. We've sent some tech away. Is the green movement racist? And an interview with sustainable Italian-English clothing brand 4M. Joining me to discuss these and more as usual is Russell. Morning, Russell.
Morning, Mike. I've heard a lot about this interview, so I'm looking forward to hearing that. You do realise, listeners, that I don't get the privilege of hearing the interview until I have to listen to the show myself. So, you know, I join you in that event.
I'm wondering who you've heard a lot from. I don't know, but anyway. Also coming up are a challenge update, sustainability news, of course, feedback, behind the scenes, eco tips, and as ever, the return of fact or fake. We'll also be talking about Bridgestone, Butcher, Block, Beyond Meat, Toyota, Tesla, Space, Hydrogen, Water, Brazil, Lights, Planes, Sneakers, Jewelry, Insects, Gorillas, and Hippos. So a number of slightly unexpected stories related to climate change have come to our notice this week, and it's been a bumper news week. So there are loads of stories around. I think all those PR execs have got back after Christmas and written the stories and got them out, and they've all flooded the news in the last week. So we've been inundated with things. But
lockdown has inspired a whole stack of reports to be finished.
It has, yes. Firstly, hundreds of Pacific islands are getting bigger despite global warming and sea level rises. Scientists at the University of Auckland found that atolls in the Pacific nations of Marshall Islands and Kiribati, as well as the Maldives in the Indian Ocean, have grown up to 8% in size over the past six decades, despite sea level rise. So I wouldn't have expected that.
No, I mean, looking at some of the pictures they show in this article that we'll link to in the show page is kind of almost looks like more like islands joining together than necessarily a fundamental growth in their outward mass. They're kind of filling in all the spaces in between, but they aren't shrinking.
The messages are all about sea level rises and ice melts and we're all going to be underwater. And
yeah,
research shows that not always the case.
Linking to another one of the stories you've got later on, I think, is healthy coral reefs seem to be important in all of this, which is interesting. The more healthy the coral reef, the more adaptive it seems to be to this changing environment. So, hey, the Earth is an amazing thing. It keeps on shocking us, doesn't it? I can react to that. I can clean the oceans quickly.
And then we've got a story about the desert continuing to grow in the Southern Sahara, despite what's known as the Green Wall. Thomas Sankara, who's the president of, was the president of Burkina Faso, launched a massive tree planting drive to re-green the country, halt soil erosion and foster sustainable agriculture. This fight against the desert was both ideological and existential, and was trying to guarantee the survival of his nation, really, because it's landlocked and the Sahara was eating it up.
And all the water that landed on his land ran off to
Everybody else's land.
Had a coast, yeah.
I like this statement. This is a good statement from him. He said, "Step by step, tree by tree, we will create this great park of 10 million trees," he promised, "even if it takes 10 million years.
Yeah, so, not the most challenging target.
One tree a year wasn't that ambitious. And we complain about companies who want to be neutral by 2050, but a tree a year seems positively.
I'll get there. You know, and sub-Saharan desert, sub-Saharan Africa is under massive threat. If nothing else, it's the place where all the fires are happening as well.
Yeah.
If you look on Firewatch sites, you'll see that band between the Sahara and the lush grounds of the rest of the Africa are under attack in multiple ways. So, yeah, horrific. The Sahara desert. It's massive. It's beautiful, but horrifically beautiful when you think about what it's eaten to get there.
Yeah. It just unexpected, side effects of our changing climate, really, not helped by some of the tree felling that has gone on in previous decades. Yeah. There were trees in these sub-Saharan countries. They've been cut down for, you know, construction of various types, and that has had a knock-on.
Eroding the soil away, yeah, it's awful.
In fact, and then we have a story about ocean temperatures continuing to rise. Apparently the world's oceans absorbed 20 sextillion joules of heat due to climate change in 2020.
It's probably one of the least useful stats I've ever had in my life. And one, you've got to figure out what 20 sextillion is, and then you've got to work out what a joule is.
Yeah. And I enjoyed this, and we'll link to this in the show page. But that quantity expressed numerically as 20, and it's got
22. I counted them.
22 zeros after it. Yeah. It's the equivalent energy from 10 Hiroshima atomic bombs being released every second of the year. That's a lot of heat going into the sea.
The
seas are big.
An illustration of something I'd never seen apart from, you know, stock footage. I have no idea what the temperature in the middle of Hiroshima is. I guess it's pretty high.
Yeah.
But yeah, the ocean's a big place. It's got a lot of surface area to get heated up, but it's not shedding it by the looks of it. And it is then, as I mentioned before, it's starting to bleach corals and I think they said it's the 2020 was the hottest on record.
And that was confirmed again this week. We did the first of those reports. I think it was on the show the last week or the week before from the Copernicus Institute. But that's been confirmed now. There's a report from NASA and a report from somewhere else this week also confirming that 2020 was the warmest year on record. So
now we've got the warmest oceans to match it.
Yeah, yeah. Insects now, and they continue to vanish at an alarming rate, according to a story by National Geographic and the University of Connecticut. It's long been known that insects are disappearing at a percentage point or two a year, but that rate of disappearance is increasing. And I think one of the worrying things was insects could decline, lose as much as a third of all their insects in 2 decades.
I hop back to it once again. I used to take a trip, used to go for a drive up to up the M5 when I first had a car. And halfway through, you'd pull over not to fill up with petrol, but to clean your windscreen from the amount of insect debris.
Yeah.
Because you just couldn't see through it. Doesn't happen now.
You don't have that anymore, do you?
The odd splat would be the odd. But we have done a lot of damage to the insect world. And I think it's killing the diversity as well, because then what you do is you get other insects which get a hold. Mm. And they're not the insects we want. They're not pollinators.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or they bite or whatever it is. So, this is really worrying.
So there's a few stories, a couple of them sort of unexpected. And I think it's the fear of what we don't know that's going on in the world. I'd like to think that we're quite well informed because we look at this stuff every week. And obviously we bring the stories to the listeners on the podcast every week. So we got a better idea of what's going on, but we don't know what's going on all around the world in all sorts of areas and ecosystems and areas of climate change. And it's all those unexpected and unknown pieces that are really worrying. And,
we've discussed island life, Saharan desert, planting trees, the heat of the oceans and the drop of insects in, you know, what, four minutes.
Yeah.
And that's a drop in the ocean, to coin a
brain. Yes, indeed. And I guess the worrying thing is when we talk about, you know, government stories about the solutions, about the policies and the legislation and what they're doing, they only ever address a couple of points that are fashionable at that moment. You know, whether it's fast fashion is the point of the moment, or plant-based diets is the thing at the moment, and all the other stuff gets completely ignored. We had a really good piece of feedback from a listener early in the week about chemicals, which we'll come on to later in the show. But there are so many things that just fly under the radar that don't get any notice, and
because they're not the subject of a recent report.
Yeah. I mean, it's worrying. I mean,
one of these things.
Would really like to know what listeners think. Are there any unexpected, unknown climate, environment, social stories that you think we should be talking about on the show that aren't getting the news and the headlines they deserve? If there are, drop us a note on social at Green Elephant Pod, or you can email the show. It's studio@greenelephantshow. And we'd love to hear, and we'll bring those stories to you. So moving on, it's our monthly challenge, and we're doing tech recycling in January. And first of all, want to bring you a really useful resource, and this comes from the IEEE, and a recommendation from them. So the IEEE is the Institute of Electrical and Something Engineers. Electrical and something else, and somebody will tell us. I can't remember what the third E is for. Anyway, it's all about, it's the trade body for electricians and that kind of thing. This site is recycleyourelectricals.org.uk, and we'll link that in the show page. But this is a really, really useful site. And the headline says, anything with a plug, battery or cable can be reused or recycled. And the site goes on to say, well, what can you do with your old electricals? You can repair them, you can donate them, you can sell them, you can recycle them. So it gives you kind of some choices to what you do. And it gives you options by the type of device, by kind of condition. So, and it gives you some locations to find to do one of those four things, whether it's repair or donate or sell or recycle. And so I, you know, as I have a number of things I'm looking to do something with, I thought, oh, I'll type that into the locator. And I thought that I would just find my local household recycling site. But I was very surprised to see that the likes of O2, Vodafone, Currys, which are an electrical retailer in the UK, all came up as recycling points for electrical items. So it appears that was new knowledge to me that some of the electrical retailers in the UK do take old electronic devices for recycling. So I'm going to be putting this to the test. And unfortunately, I may not be able to do this in the next couple of weeks during our challenge.
Lockdown is prevented.
Because we are locked down. Now, we have a Currys in the local town, and I have an old Bush TV soundbar, which, you know, it's not worth anything, and it still works, got a plug. So I'm going to try and take that into this local Currys when it's open and when I can, to see if they'll recycle it. So I'll bring that story to you when I've done that. It'd be really interesting to see if this big retailer will take this old piece of electrical equipment back, as it says.
You
on
get a video interview with the guy on the
yeah, I mean, we'll do a video of it. We'll do a video of certainly of me walking in. We'll see if we can do some stuff inside. We'll do a video of me walking out.
Yeah, seeing we can't get together to do our video show,
probably with a soundbar under my arm. So, so that's a really good site. Go and have a look at that. It's really useful to see what to do with things. So, so I had a look at that, and I've made some decisions on what I'm going to do with the. At the start of January, I listed a few things that I had that needed to be disposed of in some way that were old tech. So I had loads and loads of leads lying around, and I have sent those away. They've gone in a big envelope to a cable recycling company. I forget the website. I will put a link in the show page.
Good but point.
So leads have gone and been recycled. Mm-hmm. So they are going to recycle the PVC coatings, take the metal out, and any electrical components in the connectors or something. They recycle those as well. So that's the leads.
Okay.
I had a USB sound card and an old microphone, which I'm going to go and try and sell those. I think they might be useful to somebody, so we'll try that one.
What? Where are you going to try and sell those?
Probably on eBay, I expect. I might give a Gumtree a go, or maybe a Facebook Marketplace.
Facebook Marketplace is interesting, but of course, a lot of them being shut down lately because there are a lot of. It's essentially a collection and a touch point. So
yes.
Yeah,
okay. Probably in post on eBay then.
Yeah.
The sound bar obviously we'll take to Curry's in the near future when we can, and the old iPhone 5S I'm going to donate it to somebody. So if any of our listeners would like an old iPhone 5S, and we'll put this out on social.
Is this one of the phones you dropped, Mike?
One of the ones I dropped. Where did I drop a phone? Don't remember that.
Show me the screen of your 7.
Oh yeah, my current iPhone 7 has a cracked screen. The iPhone 5 is perfect.
Yeah, no, nice phones to be honest. There's five
options. So I'm going to find somebody to donate that to. As we had a few listeners suggest that, you know, it might be nice to donate it to a child that needs a bit of internet access for school or whatever. So so I'm going to donate that. So if any listener would like that, then get in touch and let us know. Right. The green movement remains overwhelmingly white, according to
a report. That's a white movement then.
Well, it should be called that. But a report released by Green 2.0, an independent advocacy campaign that tracks racial and gender diversity with the environmental movement. They found that while strides have been made in recent years, it has been an incremental pace and needs improvement at all levels. The data found that from 40 of the largest non-profit environmental organisations in the country and the top 40 foundations and grant providers show that on average they added 6 people of colour and 8 women to their full-time staff between 2017 and 2020, and added 2 people of colour and 2 women to their senior staff in that time. And this is the most damning one, I guess. 1 person of colour and 1 woman to their boards since 2017. So 4 years on average.
Of the 40 largest not-profit environmental groups.
Foundations, yeah. Groups and foundations.
So that's 80 companies have appointed 1 woman and 1 person of colour since 20 in 3 years.
So it's pretty damning, really. That
not great, is it? I mean, there's always a niggle in the back of my head is that there's just not people that want to do it, but we know from our audience that there's a lot of female interest in our sustainability, disproportionate such.
Yeah,
so why aren't they represented on the board?
Why aren't 70% of boards females? Because that's what our audience tells
Especially
us.
Environmental groups. And
foundations. So it's, you know, why should they be white men?
When I read this article, what did play in my head is look at the top 10 richest people on earth, and what will you find about them?
White men.
I mean, shockingly, just across the board, white men. And you just have to say that that's probably representative of the. Sorry. representative of the of. Why people don't come to sit on these boards is because, you know, it's the white men that have made their way to the top, and they and there's nobody really encroaching on that from a female or a person of color perspective. So
I guess it must be, you know, incredibly difficult. I mean, we've sat on boards of various large companies, and if you are the only female on that board, it must be a very difficult and intimidating and daunting place to be. So why would you want to be the first woman? Surely you would want to be in a group of several.
That's right.
In that situation. That's
disappointing.
It is disappointing. And particularly when you know, the white men are not the people who are making the buying choices every day about, you know, what food you're going to eat, whether you're going to go plant-based, what clothes you're going to wear, whether you're going to use recycled cotton or organics, or, you know, what kitchenware you're going to buy, or what bathroom products, you know, and whether all these things are sustainable. Those are all decisions that are made by, generally,
yeah,
generalization, but made by females. So why should, you know, white men be in charge of the organizations that are trying to, you know, run the green movement? It does seem that there's something amiss.
But I suppose what I was trying to say is that it's interesting in the climate movement related to incomes, and are we looking at the fact that the people of colour, especially, which has been noted that they can come from more deprived or low income families, and that because we said before, sometimes it costs a little bit more to be that little bit more sustainable, and that's hard when you're on a tight budget.
Yeah, that shampoo bar costs more than the bottle of liquid that you get at your large box supermarket
by factors of 10.
Yeah,
on some so, an interesting challenge, that one.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be interesting to hear what listeners think about that one.
Yeah.
Okay, let's have a look in brief at some other big sustainability news stories from the weekend. First up, we have some trainers, formerly known as Dope Kicks. these sneakers or trainers are called 8,000 Kicks, and they're the world's first ethically made, waterproof cannabis sneakers. So crafted from a woven textile derived from hemp, known to be strong and flexible and durable. More of these shoes and materials is great. You know, bamboo, hemp, these fast growing, very durable, very environmentally friendly materials. There's no reason why we shouldn't have more of these things, as long as people don't try and smoke them when they've finished wearing them.
It makes you wonder whether any of the tetrahydrocannabidol
seep
into your skin, but presumably such low levels you'd be okay.
Yeah.
Looking at rubber, which is probably might be on the bottom of those shoes, you never know. Rubber, obviously a big use of rubber is in our tires on our cars, and there's an estimate that we carry on growing as we will, by 2050 we'll have 2.4 billion cars, which by all maths is nearly 10 billion tires.
Doesn't matter whether your car's electric or hydrogen, it needs the rubber tires on the wheels.
And so Bridgestone Corporation, famous tire company, I don't know, do they hold the Formula One thing at the moment? It changes so often.
Possibly.
And they're looking at ways of producing one high yield rubber farms, which always makes me chuckle, and also how to produce that more sustainably, making more stable process. So that's good news. You know, it's an unstoppable. I can't see us stopping using cars or vehicles, lorries, to get our food stuff around and ourselves around. But
I guess it's all the other stuff they put with the rubber once they've, you know, rubber from a rubber tree isn't that harmful. It's when you mix it with all the other chemicals.
Vulcanized and all the other stuff. Yeah.
Anyway, B Corp stories now, and always happy to give a mention to fellow B Corps or new B Corps, as the story has here. So ButcherBox has announced that it's become a B Corporation. So well done, ButcherBox. Great thing to do. This company, it does humanely raised meat and sustainably sourced seafood. It's just brilliant that, you know, if we're going to eat meat, if we're going to have meat and seafood, then, you know, the very least we can do is raise it humanely, grow it sustainably, and so on. So that's absolutely great. You know, they have aspirations such as healthy cows, inspired consumers, thriving farms, enduring ecosystems, enrich communities and things like that. So that's, you know, that's a far cry from some of the mass meat farms we see elsewhere on the planet. So yeah, well done to them.
Okay, well, from waste line to waste washed ashore.
Not quite.
Okay. No. So I have to work on my
you have to work on your links there.
So artist in Oregon has been using waste that's been washed up on their shore near Brandon to create artwork. And this is definitely one worth going to the show page and
our listeners. You need to go to the show page and have a look at
it. She's created some amazing stuff. Her name's Angela Hazeltine Posse, and she's created this company, Washed Ashore, and she searches for trash and then they turn it into these amazing pieces of art. Some of it sculpture, some of it more on the wall, but all using the stuff that's put up on the show, on the seashore, and you know, tells the story that there's enough there for her to have no struggle making some quite significant pieces of art.
I'm trying to decide whether the piranha or the puffin is my favourite.
I like the puffin.
Do you? Okay.
Like the puffin. I think that's really nice.
Oh, that's good.
Like his eyebrows.
Fake meat now, and Beyond Meat, who we've discussed before, they have had a boost in their fortune this week as they've signed a deal with the Taco Bell on new menu items. Now, Taco Bell isn't somebody I would associate with plant-based or sustainable kind of practices, but Beyond Meat has signed a deal, and if you're going to Taco Bell in future, you'll be able to get meat-free items on the menu. So, yeah.
Yeah, we don't see many Taco Bells down this part of the world.
We don't, but good for them.
I've been to one in America, but it should be interesting. Yeah. Moving back to cars again, but I found this quite an irritating story, to be honest. Toyota to pay a record fine for a decade, 10 years of Clean Air Act violations. So Toyota are the second largest after the very well-renowned emissions expert Volkswagen, who are number one. Toyota obviously just flaunt the clean air and pay the penalties, because the penalties have summed up to $180 million, which is just trifling for a company of that size.
It's a lot of money, but if it's over 10 years, it's what, $18 million a year,
which is in terms of their turnover and their profit margins is not significant enough.
And you think what they would have to change in their whole manufacturing system to comply with the Clean Air Act, it would cost them hundreds of millions. So they've just said, oh, we'll just pay a fine every year, that's fine.
Yeah, and we've seen this before where Facebook, the same thing, where they encroached on people's personal privacy. They just paid the bill because it was going to cost them too much to fix it.
Cheaper to pay the fine. And
so shame on Toyota for doing it, for one. Yeah. Shame on the Environmental Protection Agency for being a bunch of wusses.
Yeah.
We want to see that at $1.8 billion, please. That will
make the fine meaningful, so they actually change their behaviours.
Not meaningful 10 years under name.
And on to the world's biggest car maker now, Tesla.
Are they the biggest now, are they?
They are the biggest, yeah. They're bigger than Ford and Toyota and Mercedes and some combined. They're huge. Yeah, they are the biggest. But they've been told they have to recall 158,000 Model S and Model X vehicles because their media control units have failed. So, you know, the shiny beacon of the electric future is not without its issues. And they've had a minor recall in the past, but this is a recall of a significant number of vehicles. And I guess worrying when, you know, we're moving to more and more autonomous driving, and you know, you're trusting that these things are going to drive themselves, and yet a huge number here have been recalled for errors.
And you end up with redundancy and stuff to cope with it. It's an interesting one, because I did hear very early on in Tesla's life how they stopped what would have been a rollback with the suspension fault by issuing a patch. and they issued a patch, and overnight they fixed a whole stack of suspension systems.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, there's swings and roundabouts in that particular game, but it's a shame to hear. Looking over now to France, where they have started a renewable hydrogen production site at Châteauneuf-les-Martigues. I'm going to say that is. So down on the...
Your French accent is this.
Oh, yeah, I know. I can roll my R's. this is down in the more sunny spots of the world. So they got this biorefinery powered by solar farms with a capacity of more than 100 megawatts. And they are going to produce 5 tons of green hydrogen a day and avoid 15,000 tons of CO2 emissions a year. Yeah. So, you know, we said for some time is that solar and wind isn't going to do it all. Hydrogen, especially on the road, hydrogen in the air, hydrogen is probably going to be the way for us to go.
Yeah, yeah. It certainly is. It's hydrogen is going to be the future for us. We talked previously about satellite tracking from space. We've talked about deforestation tracking, where you can go and help with that. We've talked about tracking of wildfires. We talked about the Japanese wooden satellites. But this week, it's a plan to track species from space. So wondering where animals move, how they move. Now using satellites to track the movement of species, because we still don't know where some species migration occurs. They've talked about blackbirds in France and fruit bats in Zambia. Now I'm keen to know where the fruit bats in Zambia go. But they've put these tracking devices on them with a bit of solar.
Ah.
And then using less than 5 grams. These are tiny devices that they're putting on these creatures, and then they're collecting information from that tag, and it's not just the position, it's about the climate they're flying through as well. So it's an interesting data set that's being collected.
Don't get me wrong, these things are solar powered and they bunged them on a bat.
Yeah, but don't forget,
don't bats fly at night?
You've obviously forgotten about fact or fake from a few months ago.
Oh, I know.
Our solar powered fact or fake.
It is like an insignificant. It does still do it, but it's anyway. I'm not gonna. Let's not go. Let's look at water pipes.
Okay.
Because I know it's your favourite subject, is to where your number twos go.
Right. Yes.
So we're starting to see they're going to do the Internet of Things, or the IoT is not the Internet of Things, might be the Internet of Turds, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
and they're going to track what's going on in our water pipes in our smarter cities. So apart from starting to put smart water meters on houses, which obviously is just an extension of the smart electricity and gas meters we've got already, is a valuable utility that we do take for granted, that this water just turns up beautifully clean out of our taps and then runs away and miraculously makes it
disappears
clean to the sea.
I think one of the big problems is finding leaks, finding problems, fixing those problems, because it's all underground and you don't know where they are, and you know, if you're putting pressure monitors and flow meters and acoustic sensors and temperature sensors and things like these into all these pipes, you can much more quickly and easily fix all the problems as they come along.
And I mean, that's exactly the reason. Now, part of it obviously enables them to be quicker to respond and save themselves money. But there will be, I'm sure, fines incurred if they continue to don't maintain their water systems enough. And of course, then there's the pollutant aspect of when it's gone through systems and is at the other end. So, good news. Internet of Things is moving underground.
Some not so great news. We talk about COVID, coronavirus, and the impact it's had. Yeah. It's also has an impact on animals. This week, two gorillas tested positive at a zoo in San Diego. So, you know, it's spreading to ape species as well. So, from bats to humans to apes. So yeah,
and we already know cats and dogs can get it as well. Yeah. So it's an insidious virus, this COVID SARS virus.
Yeah.
So good news.
No.
Brazil environmental fines fall 20%.
No.
Oh, as deforestation soars. This is so disappointing. The federal agency in Brazil gave out 9,500 fines in 2020 in comparison to nearly 12,000 in 2019. But the amount of rainforest being lopped down was equivalent, I've lost now, is the equivalent of, I couldn't see how many, it was a number of Londons in there somewhere. There it is, seven times the size of London. Now, we know London to be, the city of London to be 1 square mile, but I'm assuming they mean Greater London. That is massive.
Yeah.
7 times the size of London is just ginormous. And for that, they've stopped finding them because it doesn't...
Well, it's there. Ongoing, the current Little administration there, President Bolsonaro, they're only interested in commercialization and financial success, and the forest is a resource to be used to move those ambitions forward, and not
and to be honest, the way to stop this is not by himself or them self-managing this, but we need to vote with our feet. Stop buying stuff that gets farmed in Brazil under those circumstances. Yeah. They cannot see a financial commercial reward out of deforestation of the Amazon. That's the trouble. Until we stop buying stuff.
Yeah, they'll keep doing it. Light pollution now. It's becoming an ever bigger problem as more and more lights are used. We used to have street lights on timers. We used to not have nearly so many lights anyway. We used to turn them off. They used to be less bright, and there are some pictures, if you have a look at the links in the show page, of the changes in, because satellite imagery can show us light pollution at night from space, and you can just clearly see it growing. And they've got India is the country they've chosen, and you can just see the light pollution. Now, not only does it affect humans, because with all the light pollution we have physical mental issues with sleep patterns and things like that, but also biodiversity struggles with that day-night rhythm as well. So it's having an impact on any number of creatures. We've already discussed insects today.
Yeah.
But they get confused as to, well, is it day, is it night? When am I meant to be hunting, flying around, finding my food? So light pollution is becoming an ever-increasing problem.
It is. And when you look at some of the pictures, you think this... They're lighting up for pretty. They're not lighting up for functional.
Yeah.
I know you don't have a strong affinity or desire to consider anything Las Vegas. I went to Las Vegas about 15 years ago. And on top of one of the hotels was a 15 million candle watt power light beam that went up into the air. And because it was there, all the insects went there. And because they were there, all the bats flew through catching insects. So it's a giant insect trap for bats, easy feeding. But it was just for show. There was no other purpose for it than show, and you do question why do we need so many streetlights? Why do we need so much prettiness in the world? And maybe at the moment we do.
That's our story on Christmas lights, wasn't it? Really,
it is.
Yeah.
So energy, the United States Air Force now has started a construction on a $403 million energy savings contract.
And I thought this was really interesting, because when you get a huge organization like the US military,
yes,
which is huge, who says we're going to issue a contract for energy savings.
Yeah.
It just sends that message, doesn't it, to the rest of the world, that energy saving is important. If we're going to do it, perhaps you should be thinking about it.
Yeah. And I mean, if the US military, I mean, not just energy, but, you know, with regards to their supply chain.
Yeah.
They are a massive consumer. All the militaries across the world are a massive consumer of resources and metals and fuels and foodstuffs. And it's a place that we should be looking and saying, no, we need you to be an ecologically friendly. What I was quite surprised is our links to the British Army is their push towards more sustainability and more recycling is probably a little slow, but it is there. Yeah. But they do need to move up it. So interesting.
Yeah, and that's the end of the news for the week. So I'm delighted today to welcome on to the Green Elephants show two sisters from a company called 4M. I've got Lara and Katya joining me today, and we're going to talk a bit about their sustainable fashion brand. So hello, Lara.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for having us.
You're very welcome. And hello, Katya.
Hi. Thank you for having us.
No, thank you ever so much for joining us. So my first question, I guess, is I do a little bit of work with one brother. What's it like working with four sisters?
That's a good question. So we are, as you said, we are four sisters, and we have really different personalities and backgrounds, really. And we are of different ages as well. My sister Katya, she's much older than me, actually. So we are two generations, let's say. It's kind of interesting, I guess, to kind of work together. We started this business also to kind of do something together as a family, to work with sisters. We do have different ideas most of the times. We do argue because I guess it's normal.
Yeah.
But we always try to kind of listen to each other, which is always great. And I guess like a really great thing is that we know that we can kind of count on each other because we know each other. So we know the skills of each other. So we know what someone is good at. So we know what the roles of each one of us should be in the company and what we are able to do. Yeah. And we also know if someone maybe is busy, we don't push them too much, because we should say that we all have like full-time jobs and education out of our company and out of 4M. So we know that we have other things in life to do. So we kind of try to, be as good as possible on each other and kind of, try to give out the roles I guess it's been fun. We're still getting used to it, but
I mean, that's great having that support there, especially, I guess, when you're doing 4M as well as other, jobs and education at the same time, that can be quite challenging.
Yeah, it is.
Running a business and learning and teaching and being a mum catcher.
Yeah, exactly. Full-time job and,
which
is quite fun.
Yeah. So just to explain, so 4M is, it's based both in London and Italy and in Milan. So did it start in London
So basically of course we're Italian, but I moved to London in 2006.
Okay.
So I'm Italian, but I've been here a long time.
Yes.
Lara and Fiamma moved here 3 years ago.
Okay.
So now they're both in Italy, but they studied here. So when we started 4M, so then Erica was the other sister, she lives in Italy and she's going to stay there.
So is the idea that the sustainable clothing brand, which we'll come on to in a second, is it a London-based thing or is it an Italian thing? Or is it a London base with an Italian influence? Or how does that work?
So because I'm here and Lara and Fiamma were here as well, and we started 4M about a year ago, a little longer than that. But we were like three of us were in London and Erica was in Italy. So from a logistic point of view, it was much easier to start a company here. So we looked, for example, for a manufacturer.
So why sustainable clothing brand and why not just some other clothing brand or, you know, some other business? Why was it sustainable clothing that you decided to start?
Okay, so as Lara said, we have got different backgrounds and we don't have an education in fashion or anything like that. Mm. We do completely different things in life. So I've always been interested in crafts and sewing and knitting and everything which is linked to dressmaking. And I used to do it as a hobby. And I used to actually sew dresses for Lara most of the time.
Yeah. she made my prom dress. So when I was in America, my exchange student. So yeah.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah.
Yeah. So the idea of creating clothes, especially dresses, was something which we could relate to. And because also, you know, we're ladies, so we like
to, yes, yes, of course.
You know, wear dresses and, you know, And then, but as I said, we don't have a background in fashion. So when we started, we were not really aware of the industry. Okay. But the first thing you learn about it is the amount of waste that is produced in fashion. And, you know, starting from the fabrics you buy to the production, I mean, you know,
of course. It's very interesting because I just did an interview yesterday with somebody that's very interested in circular fashion, but they are they've been in the industry for years. They know all about the supply chains and the problems with labor and the problems with waste, and they come at it from an existing knowledge. And it's really interesting that you kind of came in with no knowledge have discovered those things. And then what was it, was there anything in particular that made you decide we want to do a sustainable approach to fashion? Was there any
So as I said, because I've always made dresses more as a hobby, you look at it from a kind of personal perspective. It's more like, for me it was always more of a crafting, like an art kind of thing. So in my small little living room, I would when you look at it from that point of view, and then you want to create a fashion business, and you see that actually this is not what's happening in the fashion industry. You don't have a lady who makes that fun dress when, it's mass production and it's meters and meters of fabrics. So you think, does it have to be like that really? Can we maybe go back to how it was maybe like years ago where, dresses were made with a purpose almost, because it takes a long time to produce one dress. And even, just... if you think about making a pattern, it requires a lot of experience, expertise. So it shouldn't be something like you do like in 10 minutes.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I was really interested to read about your mission, and you've got the kind of the three statements about be sustainable, bring change and make it last. And what do those things mean to you? Because they can mean many things to different people. I mean, be sustainable,
for me, be sustainable. I mean, if you think about sustainability, I think everyone has its own definition of it. Okay. For us, is right now, it's being sustainable. The business has to be sustainable for us, so it has to be something which we can manage long term. So for it to be sustainable, so we have, as I said, full time job, different things to do. So has to be sustainable for us, and that's why we started quite small, because that's also part of who we are. We don't want to we couldn't even thinking of starting really big, because we don't have the time, we don't have the resources for it. So that's, I guess, our sustainability kind of message. So make it, so bring change. Again, it's when you look at the fashion industry, it has become just like mass production and huge quantities, And, you know, it's, I almost think it's a bit like we should kind of go back to what it was, rather than just produce and produce and produce and change, you know, that's every day.
Kind of bring value to clothes, I would say.
Yeah, so bring back the values that the clothes should have, you know, maybe because it's...
Encourage customers to kind of take care of their clothes as well, and really think what you're buying. And
we had a discussion a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, and we've put some things out on the on social, which our listeners have kind of picked up on, which is, you know, when you buy something, an article of clothing, you should think about your what's your cost per wear. So instead of going to Primark and paying £5 for a T-shirt, which you wear once or twice, you know, perhaps it's better to buy a really good quality item and think you're going to wear it. You're going to wear this item for a lifetime rather than just once or twice. So, so making it last is absolutely.
Making it last, it should be something. I mean, I've got, you know, clothes in my wardrobe, which I bought more than 10 years ago, maybe. But I feel like, you know, I still wear them and I kind of also get attached to them. Yes. The clothes, so I really don't want to throw them out because it's almost like part of who I am. You know, there is that jacket that I always wear. Like, you know, spring comes and I'm wearing that jacket.
And it should be like this with all the clothes. I would say, you know, you have to know what clothes you have in the wardrobe, and you would have to wear them like over and over.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to move on to your kind of production process, because I think you are unique. I mean, we talk about all sorts of companies every week on our podcast, and pretty much 80 or 90% of the time we say, well, they're telling us that they're being more green and they're using recycled materials and they're doing carbon reduction and things like that, which is great. But pretty much 80, 90% of the time, they're ignoring their supply chain. And so they may be green, but they're using people and materials and practices which aren't sustainable or aren't ethical or aren't, you know, good for the environment. And I was really interested to see that you've kind of got that baked in already, all that whole supply chain piece you guys seem to have really well established already. And I was
we try.
I was really impressed. So tell me about your fabrics and your supplies of those fabrics.
So that was really, I think, our biggest challenge. I mean, we're still improving and we're not 100%, you know, I mean, we are happy with our suppliers 100%, but I'm sure we can still improve. So that was a big challenge. First of all, if you're a small company, it's very difficult to buy.
But particularly because again it's still mass production, so even the fabrics are mass production, so you would have to buy really, really high quantities, which doesn't really make sense actually, because that would mean that you would still have fabrics that can end up to waste. So what we want to do is to find fabrics that not only is sustainable and made fairly, but it's also something you can buy at really small quantities, because we don't want to have anything in stock that will actually end up to waste.
The manufacturing, you call it manufacturing, but I would say it's almost like a I don't know if I have these in Italy, but in the UK we had what we refer to as a traditional cottage industry, which is a person in their cottage making something, and it's much more like that than manufacturing. Tell us about that making process.
So the making of our dresses, we started, as Katja said, in London, where we, again, finding our manufacturer was quite challenging because you have to find someone that you can trust and someone who would, of course, someone that we can pay fair wages and someone that works under fair conditions. So we wanted to find someone that was really close to our premises. And so it took some time, but we were able to find someone that was really close. And that meant and means that we can go there and talk to them all the time. So we know the person who makes our dresses, and it's a really small team. So we know that they work in really great conditions, and we pay them fair wages. But the really great thing, I believe, is that we meet them all the time. So every time we have to make a dress, we go there, we talk to them, we see what they're doing. And the same we're doing in Italy at the moment. So we wanted to start our production in Italy as well, because I mean, we are Italian, and it's also best for orders that come out from Italy, so that we can send them from Italy, so that's best for delivery. But also because, I mean, we want to introduce our Made in Italy collections as well. Okay. And here again, I'm in Italy at the moment. So I was the one who was in charge of finding the manufacturer. And I found this lady. And again, she's literally 5 minutes drive from here. Yeah. So every time we have to make a dress, I go there and talk to her, and I show the dress, I show her the fabric, I show her the pattern. So we really talk with each other, and I know where she works and who she works with. So, and I know that we pay her fair wages, and she works in really good conditions.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's fantastic. And you're obviously extremely passionate about that side of things. And it's great to see. Related to that, which I really liked, was you call your process on demand, and a lot of people think on demand would be I can have it next day, or I can have it really quickly, but for you, on demand means that we make things for the customer and it will take 10 to 15 days. And I think that to me says something about the quality of the garment and the process and the care that kind of goes into it, you know, the fact that it takes that length of time to do.
I think that it's one of our, you know, main thing for reducing waste, and one of the things they were really proud about, because you know, our dresses are made only when people place an order, so we don't have anything in stock. So and our premises just have the samples, but we don't have anything else. And this also goes for the fabric, as we said, we don't want to buy a lot of fabrics, because that would be stock as well.
Yes.
And so when we make a dress, we, you know, I would, as I said, I will go to the manufacturer, I would talk to her, and I would tell her what dress needs to be made, and she would make it at that time after the order has been placed. So it means that it would take longer, but I mean, I think it's worth it.
Definitely worth it. And it's lovely to see that you not only start with sustainable fabrics and sourcing the right supplies and then getting it made in an ethical way, but then you package it in a really eco-friendly, sustainable way as well. So the whole thing, and it's really unusual. I mean,
we use compostable bags, so you can use it, you know, at home.
So I'm not a female, and I don't know about women's fashion, but I would wear the dresses. Is there, you know, in terms of the range that you've got on there, is there something that's doing really well and that is really appealing that we should tell the listeners to go and have a look at?
I guess we would say we've just launched our new collection. So we're really kind of happy about it, because we said it's made in Italy. And so I guess if I would have to say, go check something out and then go check our, you know, our new collection, which we think, I mean, we try to make our clothes as simple as possible to make sure that they can be worn over and over, so they would never get out of style. And so this is our kind of characteristic, and our new collection, again, it's really simple. And we definitely believe that it's something that we can wear, particularly now in winter. And so, I would say go check out our new collection.
Great. So if people want to check out your clothes, we'll obviously in the show notes at greenelephant.show, we'll put links to your website and to your social media, so people can go and follow you and get involved and see what you're doing. Is that the best way to get hold of you, or is there another way you'd like people to speak to you?
Website is, of course, There is a contact form on the website as well if you want to contact us. We are on Instagram.
Yes.
Fiamma is not here, it's a social
person. Okay, that's fine.
Of the team, but I'm learning as we go. But anyway, we are on Instagram, we are on Facebook.
On Pinterest.
You can drop us a message and we'll...
Brilliant. And if anybody's interested, any listeners, we'll put them in touch if you can't find them. If a listener goes to Instagram and they think, I love the look of that dresses, they come to you to buy them. Is that the single outlet? They're not going to see these garments in
they
other
are gonna
retailers?
See us, we're on a couple of marketplaces as well.
Okay.
So, Lara, you helped me with this.
we're like on Urban Kissed. We are on El Vestito Verde, we're on Project CC, we're on Musa, Fashion Musa. So we are on different places.
So listeners might see 4M elsewhere, but I guess the key thing is look out for 4M because as we've discussed in this very brief discussion, the work you're doing is amazing. The way you're treating the whole manufacturing, production, shipping process is absolutely brilliant, and the concept behind it is absolutely it's lovely to see a small fashion brand who are really backing up the words. We quite often see people say we're sustainable, but they're not doing everything, and it's lovely to see that.
Yeah, it is a challenge. To be honest, and I think we can do. I mean, we could start it, as I said, because we have also other things in life to do. So. And I think when we decided this is going to be a sustainable brand, then we also decided we will have to stick to it. And, it has to be sustainable. Otherwise, for us at this point, it wouldn't make sense to just have a clothing fashion brand.
And it sounds like
we want to stick to our values, which is sometimes difficult to do because...
And it sounds like your son agrees with you, so that's fantastic. Lara, Katya, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure to speak to you. Listeners, go and check out 4M. Visit the show page and the details will be there. And just want to finish by wishing you the best of luck with it and hope it becomes really successful.
Thank you
very much.
Pleasure.
Feedback time now. We had a message from Sammy Cuds, who pointed us at a story about Scottish cycling brand Enduro. Now, I know about Enduro because I have some Enduro cycle clothing. And I think I bought it probably 4 or 5 years ago. But what I didn't realise was the ethical and sustainable initiatives by Enduro. They are planting a million trees a year, which, that's a significant number, maybe not big on some, if you compare it to Ecosia or organizations like that, but this is a small cycle clothing brand company. Mm. And it wasn't just the fact that they are planting a million trees, they've got all sorts of other initiatives and, just example of a company that's really doing the best they can within their means for the environment. And, More organisations should be like that. But so thanks, Sammy. That was a great story to bring to our attention.
Cool.
And the other story was from Alec Rail One, who just said, pointed us at that humans emit more than 250 billion tons of chemical compounds a year. And he says this poisonous avalanche is hurting our world.
Yeah.
And that was something that made me just stop and think. And I was doing an interview that's going to be coming up in a few weeks with Ethical Lives, who do some of what they do is sort of skincare products, and we're talking about chemicals. And back to our story about unexpected things, chemicals is something that we've not talked a lot about on the show, but I think is a massive hidden problem that we should spend some time on in the future, because big oil and energy, big tech, they get the lion's share of the news coverage and the kind of the hate from the environmental lobby.
Yeah.
What about the huge chemicals industry that is pervasive in everything? It goes under the radar. So, yeah. Again, thanks for the tip off, and we'll look more into that story.
Can we do a challenge behind that, perhaps? Perhaps any ideas challenge we could put on the chemical? I think it would be interesting to know. You know, do you really know what chemicals you got under your sink?
Yeah, absolutely. So any stories like that that listeners think we should be talking about, then look us up on social at Green Ellie Pod, and we will be happy to give you a mention and talk about them. A quick look behind the scenes now at the Green Elephant Show, and firstly, an apology. We did say that we were going to be launching a video show at the start of the year, and that was fully our intention. However, we are locked away at home again, and therefore getting together to make a video show has been a little bit tricky.
I got the biohazmat suit.
Oh, have you?
Okay. Yeah. It makes it difficult to mic up, but it's, you know.
You didn't get matching ones, though, so I don't have one.
Yours was pink.
but on the video side, we are making a video at the end of the week to do with our Planet Plug product that's coming soon and the crowdfund. If you want to know a little bit more, a little sneak preview about our crowdfund, you can go to greenelephant.show. There's a small preview page on there. You can sign up and we'll be giving updates shortly. But the other thing I wanted to do today behind the scenes was just to share some of our goals for the year, which is, you know, start of the year, everybody shares their goals, what they want to achieve and what they're looking to do. And at the Green Elephant Show, where we want to go, and this is our, I think they call them BHAG or your North Star, or there's various names for, you know, what are these huge goals that you're setting for yourself. And
big fat hairy goal, I heard, was one of
that's
them.
That's the one,
yeah.
And for us on the Green Elephant Show, we want to set ourselves the target of being the biggest sustainability show online. That's quite a lofty goal. We're not quite there yet. We're getting there, but that's where we want to go, because if we make that a reality, then that would mean that there are millions of people hearing these messages and wanting to do something about their impact on the planet, on their impact on other people, and, you know, prosperity for all, not just for a few. So that's, you know, that's our kind of biggest goal. We'd also like to significantly grow our Instagram, and, you know, if we were being totally outrageously ambitious, could we get to 1 million followers this year on Instagram?
Whew.
There we are. There's a couple of huge goals, but yeah, just to let our listeners know where we're going, if you think you can help us get there, or if you've got any ideas as to what we should do or get there, then, you know, let us know. We'd be only too pleased to receive any advice, pointers, suggestions that you've got. Recommendation for the week now, and this week going to point you at Films for the Planet. Website is filmsfortheplanet.com, and this is a really interesting collection of films, documentaries, and so on that are available online for streaming. Now, there are some paid things in here, there are some free things in here, but it is a very big collection, and they're all environmental, social, climate, global warming, nature-based films and documentaries. And the site kind of wraps these up quite nicely, gives you a couple of minute trailer of each of the films, and then you can decide whether you want to go and, you know, look at that on the streaming service, you want to go and, you know, rent a copy of it. But there's hundreds of films that I'd never seen, heard of, come across, and I think you could get lost for quite a long time watching some really, really interesting documentaries, story clips,
nice
things on there. So yeah,
nicely made as well.
It is, yeah. And, you know, categories like sustainable living, human experience, the economy, food systems, peace and justice, so really interesting topic. So Films for the Planet, go and check it out. And now it's time for Fact or Fake. Feeling confident this week, Russell?
Oh, Mike, I can't tell you how confident I feel.
You don't even know what it's about this week yet.
No.
And it this
oh,
week.
Oh, yeah, but between me and my brother, we know everything.
Okay, good. We're talking about sea level rises. We talked about islands coming out of the sea at the start of the show. So this level, we're now going to talk about the rise or not of sea levels. So,
okay.
If temperatures rise by 1.5 degrees Celsius by 2100, as expected, mm-hmm. this will mean a sea level rise of 30 centimetres. That's a foot.
I would say my gut reaction to that is that's a fake. It's probably closer to 3 metres than 30 centimetres.
Well, you're right. It is a fake, but not nearly as bad as you were thinking. 70 or 80. So
all right, okay.
Maybe 3 feet. Yeah. Okay.
Oh yeah. Sorry, I meant 3 feet, not 3 meters.
3 meters. That's a lot.
That will put my house underwater.
Yeah. If all the ice that currently exists on Earth melted, mm-hmm. it would raise the sea level 216 feet.
Well, you know what? 216 feet. What's that in meters, Mike? No,
I don't know.
for our metric friends, it's
all the ice, every glacier, and every piece of ice melted.
Well, there is a lot of water stored in ice. There's a tremendous amount, especially on the mountains and glaciers. So. I say, is that a reasonable figure? I'm going to say that's a fact.
It is a fact, yeah. So 216 feet, that's a lot. Okay, so back to 2100. If sea levels rise as predicted,
yes,
approximately 200 million people can expect to see their homes submerged by 2100.
Well, we do like it by the coast, don't we?
We do.
It's like we can't help but be close to the coast in Cornwall.
So this is this 3 feet of sea rise, 2100. We think 200 million people would be submerged.
That's not in the 7.8 billion people. By then, what are we looking at? 9.6 billion by the end of next century, or something like that. So it's not a lot. I'd say that's a fact.
That is another fact.
Whoa, I told you, me and my brother know everything.
Yeah. Okay, so the country with the biggest percentage of its population at risk from rising sea levels is Vietnam.
Now, the geographical rise and fall of Vietnam leaves me... I would have thought it'd be more like the fjords, but maybe not. I'm going to, in my abject lack of knowledge on Vietnam, I'm going to have to say that's a fact.
It's not actually. It's a much more obvious country. The country with the highest, biggest percentage of its population at risk from sea level rise is, in fact, Netherlands, Holland.
Well, that's what I said. That's sort of far more likely.
You said the fjords.
Than...
They're in Norway.
Oh, are they? All right. Yeah. Well, you know, that kind of region.
rough Europe. And finally, in fact or fake, if the ice in Greenland melts, then Miami, Manhattan, London, Shanghai and Bombay would disappear underwater.
Now, Greenland's one of those funny places because of the way we draw maps on a globe, it can sometimes look bigger than Africa, but it actually actually isn't. You did say Greenland, didn't you?
I did say Greenland. If all the ice in Greenland melts, then Miami, Manhattan, London, Shanghai and Bombay would disappear underwater.
I could go for that. I'd go that as a fact.
It is a fact, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just Miami.
Well, Manhattan is, you know, is... Well, you saw that documentary, you know, day after tomorrow. Whatever. Yeah,
Miami is the one. Miami is... huge risk from any rise in sea level
because they're sitting right on all of the marshes and
yeah
yeah
and that concludes fact or fake for the week. And finally, before we go, and this wins the prize for certainly the best headline this year.
And might have spawned the most controversial graphic of the year as well.
Pablo Escobar's cocaine hippos threaten to take over Colombia.
Dun, dun, dun.
So a thing that Escobar left behind that continues to cause problems in Colombia. We're not talking about drugs, guns, or anything else so malicious. We're talking about hippos. Escobar had a penchant for exotic animals. And as he was one of the richest people in the world, he could indulge his love of strange creatures. And as a private estate, he built an entire zoo filled with elephants, antelopes, exotic birds, ostriches, and hippos. So when he died in 1993, no one was left to look after the animals. Most of them were rehomed, moved to other parts of the world. But the hippos, they were like, well, they're too big and ugly. We'll just leave them there. They'll die out eventually. And so they just left them to their own devices. But the hippos are thriving. They're breeding. They're expanding. And they're going to reach dangerous numbers in the next few years. This is a fact for you. So hippos are notoriously violent psychos.
It's an interesting turn of phrase, mate.
Their plump and docile appearance might fool you, but make no mistake, these beasts are out for blood. In fact, they are the single deadliest land mammal in the world.
I knew that. The number of deaths accounted to, I suppose, 500, it says they estimate 500 people die of hippo attacks in Africa. But we are talking about Africa is where they belong, and we're talking about South America where they don't belong. talk about swinging the ecosystem a little bit, the balance of the area. Yeah. Let's just bung a whole stack. When you said started off with cocaine hippos, I thought they were raiding the farmlands. You know?
Maybe they are. Who knows? If you've enjoyed the show, then please do go and visit the show page at greenelephant.show. You can find links to all the stories we've discussed, instructions on how to leave us a review, and links to find us on all the usual podcast providers. Please do go visit and subscribe, as it really helps to continue to make the show and hopefully keep you entertained. So hopefully see you at greenelephant.show or on social at greenelipod. But until next time, thanks for listening, and we hope you have a sustainable week.